howling in the distance. No, just kidding. But the late lamented Trey Dawson had once told me that spring is the favorite season of werewolves. There's more prey, so the hunt is over quickly, leaving more time to eat and play. Since I'd been thinking about weres, it wasn't such a surprise to hear from one. On that sunny morning in the middle of April, I was sitting on my front porch with my second cup of coffee and a magazine, still wearing my sleep pants and my Superwoman t-shirt, when the Shreveport pack leader called me on my cell phone. "Huh," I said when I recognized the number. I flipped the phone open. "Hello?" I said cautiously.
"Sookie,"
said Alcide Herveau. I hadn't seen Alcide in months. Alcide had ascended to the position of pack leader the year before in a single evening of mayhem.
"How are you?"
"Right as rain," I said, nearly meaning it. "Happy as a clam, fit as a fiddle." I watched a rabbit hop across the clover and grass 20 feet away. Spring.
"You're still dating Eric? He the reason for the good mood?"
Everyone wanted to know. "I'm still dating Eric. That sure helps keep me happy." Actually, as Eric kept telling me, dating was a misleading term. Though I didn't think of myself as married since I'd simply handed him a ceremonial knife, Eric had used my ignorance as part of his master strategy, the vampires did. A vampire-human marriage isn't exactly like a love, honor, and obey human pairing, but Eric had expected the marriage would earn me some perks in the vampire world. Since then, things had gone pretty well, vampire-wise. Aside from the huge glitch of Victor not letting Eric come to my aid when I was dying, that is. Victor, who really needed to die. I turned my thoughts away from this dark direction with the determination of long practice. See? That was better. Now I was hopping out of bed every day with, almost, my old vigor. I'd even gone to church the past Sunday. Positive. "What's happening, Alcide?" I asked.
"I got a favor to ask,"
Alcide said, not entirely to my surprise. "What can I do for you?"
"Can we use your land for our full moon run tomorrow night?"
I made myself pause to think about his request rather than automatically saying yes. I'm learning through experience. I had the open land the wares needed. That wasn't the issue. I still owned 20-odd acres around my house, though my grandmother had sold off most of the original farm when she was faced with the financial burden of raising my brother and me. Though Sweet Home Cemetery took a chunk out of the land between my place and Bill's, there'd be enough room, especially if Bill didn't mind allowing access to his land as well. I remembered the pack had been here once before. I turned the idea around to look at it from all angles. I couldn't see any obvious downside. "You're welcome to come," I said. "I think you should check with Bill Compton, too." Bill hadn't responded to any of my little gestures of concern. Vampires and werewolves are not inclined to be buddies, but Alcide is a practical man.
"I'll call Bill tonight, then," he said. "You got his number?"
I gave it to him. "Why are you all not going to your place, Alcide?" I asked, out of sheer curiosity. He told me in casual conversation that the Longtooth Pack celebrated the full moon at the Herveau farm south of Shreveport. Most of the Herveau land was left in timber for the pack hunts.
"Ham called today to tell me there's a small party of oneies camping by the stream."
Oneies, the one-natured, is what the two-natured wares call regular humans. I knew Hamilton Bond by sight. His farm was adjacent to the Herveau place, and Ham farmed a few acres for Alcide. The Bond family had belonged to the Longtooth Pack as long as the Herveaus. "Did they have you permission to camp there?" I asked.
"They told Ham my dad always gave them permission to fish there in the spring, so they didn't think to ask me. It might be true. I don't remember them, though."
"Even if they're telling the truth, that's pretty rude. They should have called you," I said. "They should have asked you if it was convenient for you. You want me to talk to them? I can find out if they're lying." Jackson Herveau, Alcide's late dad, hadn't seemed like the kind of man who'd casually allow people to use his land on a regular basis.
"No thanks, Sookie. I hate to ask you for another favor. You're a friend of the pack. We're supposed to watch out for you, not you for us."
"Don't worry about it. Y'all can come out here. and if you want me to shake hands with these supposed buddies of your dad's, I can do that. I was curious about their appearance on the Hervaux farm, so close to the full moon. Curious and suspicious. Alcide told me he'd think about the fisherman's situation and thanked me about 6 times for saying yes. No big deal, I said, and I hoped I was telling the truth. Eventually, Alcide felt he'd thanked me enough, and we hung up. I went inside with my coffee cup. I didn't know I was smiling until I looked in the living room mirror. I admitted to myself I was looking forward to the wolves' arrival. It would be pleasant to feel I wasn't alone in the middle of the woods. Pathetic, huh? Though our few evenings together were good, Eric was still spending a lot of time on vampire business. I was getting a little tired of it. Well, not a little. If you're the boss, you should be able to get some time off, right? That's one of the perks of being a boss. But something was up with the vampires. I was unhappily familiar with the signs. By now, the new regime should have been firmly in place, and Eric should have thoroughly established his new role in the scheme of things. Victor Madden should have been fully occupied down in New Orleans with the running of the kingdom, since he was Felipe's representative in Louisiana. Eric should have been left to run Area 5 in his own efficient way. But Eric's blue eyes got all glittery and steely when Victor's name came up. Mine probably did, too. As things stood now, Victor had power over Eric, and there wasn't much we could do about that. I'd asked Eric if he thought Victor might claim dissatisfaction with Eric's performance in Area 5, a terrifying possibility.
I'm keeping paperwork to prove differently, Eric said, and I'm keeping it in several places.
The lives of all Eric's people, and maybe my life, depended on Eric planting his feet firmly in the new regime. I knew so much rested on Eric's making his position impregnable, and I knew I shouldn't whine. It's not always easy to make yourself feel the way you ought to feel. All in all, some howling around the house would be a nice change. At least it would be something new and different. When I went to work that day, I told Sam about Alcide's phone call. True shapeshifters are rare. Since there aren't any others in this area, Sam occasionally spends time with others who have two forms. Hey, why don't you come out to the house, too? I suggested. You could turn into a wolf, right, since you're a pure shifter, and then you'd blend right in. Sam leaned back in his old swivel chair, glad to have an excuse to stop filling in forms. Sam, who is 30, is 3 years older than me.
I've been dating someone in the pack, so it might be fun, he said, considering the idea.
But he shook his head after a moment.
That would be like going to an NAACP meeting in blackface. Being an imitation in front of the real thing. That's why I've never gone out with the Panthers, though Calvin's told me I'd be welcome.
Oh, I said, feeling embarrassed. I didn't think of that. I'm sorry. I did wonder who he was dating, but there again, not my business.
Don't worry about it.
I've known you for years, and I should know more about you, I said. Your culture, that is.
My own family is still learning. You know more than they do.
Sam had come out when the Wares had. His mother had come out the same night. His family had had a rough time handling the revelation. In fact, Sam's stepfather had shot Sam's mother, and now they were getting divorced. No big surprise there. Is your brother's wedding back on? I said.
Craig and Deidre are going to counseling. Her parents were pretty upset that she was marrying into a family with people like me and Mom in it. They don't understand that any kids Craig and Deidre have simply can't turn into animals. It's only the firstborn of a pure shifter couple. He shrugged. I think they'll pull through, though. I'm just waiting for them to set a new date. You still willing to go with me?
Sure, I said, though I had an uneasy twitch when I pictured myself telling Eric I was going out of state with another man. At the time I'd promised Sam I'd go, the situation between Eric and me hadn't gelled into a relationship. You're assuming taking a wear as your date would be offensive to Deidre's family?
Truth be told, Sam said, the great reveal in Riot didn't go over as well for the two-natured as it did in Bon Ton.
I knew from the local news that Bon Ton had been lucky. Its citizens had simply blinked when the Wares and the other two-natured had announced their existence, taking a page from the vampire book.
"Just let me know what happens," I said, "and come out to my place tomorrow if you change your mind about having a run with the pack."
"Packmaster didn't invite me," Sam said, smiling.
"Landowner did." We didn't talk about it anymore the rest of my shift, so I figured Sam would find something else to do for his moon time. The monthly change actually runs for 3 nights. 3 nights when all the two-natured, if they can, take to the woods or the streets in their animal form. Most of the Tuis, those born with their condition, can change at other times, but the moon time, that's special to all of them, including those who'd come to their extra nature by being bitten. There's a drug you can take, I hear, that can suppress your change. Wares in the military, among others, have to use it. But they all hate to do that, and I understand they're really no fun to be around on those nights. Fortunately for me, the next day was one of my days off that week. If I'd had to come home from the bar late at night, the short distance from the car into the house might have been a little nerve-wracking with the wolves on the loose. I'm not sure how much of their human consciousness remains when the Wares change, and not all of Alcide's pack members are personal friends of mine. Since I'd be at home, the prospect of hosting the Wares was more or less carefree. When company's coming to hunt in your woods, there's no preparation to be done. You don't have to cook or clean house. However, having outside company was good motivation to complete some yard chores. Since it was another beautiful day, I put on one of my bikinis, pulled on sneakers and gloves, and set to work. Sticks and leaves and pine cones all went in the burn barrel, along with some hedge clippings. I made sure all the yard tools were put away in the shed, which I locked. I wound up the hose I'd used to water the potted plants I'd arranged around the back steps. I checked the clamp on the lid on the garbage can. I'd bought the can specifically to keep the raccoons out of the trash, but a wolf might get interested too. I passed a pleasant afternoon, puttering around in the sun, singing off-key whenever the spirit moved me. Right at dusk, the cars started arriving. I went to the window. I noticed the Wares had been considerate enough to carpool. There were several people in each vehicle. Even so, my driveway would be blocked until morning. Lucky I planned to stay at home, I thought. I knew some of the pack members, and I recognized a few of the others by sight. Hamilton Bond, who'd grown up with Alcide, pulled up and sat in his truck, talking on his cell phone. My eyes were drawn to a skinny, vivid young woman who favored flashy fashions, the kind I thought of as MTV clothes. I'd first noticed her in the hair of the dog bar in Shreveport, and she'd been assigned the task of executing injured enemies after Alcide's pack had won the Ware War. I thought her name was Janilyn. I also recognized two women who'd been members of the attacking pack. They'd surrendered at the end of the fight. Now they'd joined their former enemies. A young man had surrendered too, but he could have been any one of a dozen moving restlessly around my yard. Finally, Alcide arrived in his familiar truck. There were two other people sitting in the cab. Alcide himself is tall and husky, as Wares tend to be. He's an attractive man. He's got black hair and green eyes, and of course he's very strong. Alcide is usually well-mannered and considerate, but he has his tough side for sure. I'd heard rumors through Sam and Jason that since he'd ascended to pack leader, that tough side had been getting a workout. I noticed that Janilyn made a special effort to be at the truck door when Alcide emerged. The woman who slid out after him was in her late 20s, and she had some good, solid hips on her. She wore her brown hair slicked back into a little knob, and her camo tank top let me know she was muscular and fit. At the moment, Camo was looking around the front yard like she was the tax assessor. The man who got out the other door was a little older and a lot harder. Sometimes, even if you're not telepathic, you can tell by looking at a man that he's had a rough life. This man had. The way he moved told me he was on the alert for trouble. Interesting. I watched him because he needed watching. He had shoulder-length dark brown hair that flared around his head in a cloud of corkscrews. I found myself eyeing it enviously.
I'd always wished I could get my hair to do that. After I'd gotten over my hair envy, I noticed that his skin was the brown of mocha ice cream. Though he wasn't as tall as Alcide, he had thick shoulders on an aggressively muscled body. If I'd had a bad-to-the-bone alert on the brick path up the front porch, it would have gone off just after Corkscrew set his foot on it.
"Danger, Will Robinson," I said out loud. I'd never seen Camo or Corkscrew before.
Hamilton Bond got out of his truck and came over to join the little group, but he didn't come up the porch steps to stand beside Alcide, Corkscrew, and Camo. Ham held back. Janilyn joined him. The Longtooth pack appeared to be both expanding its ranks and rearranging its pecking order. When I answered the knock on the door, I had my hostess smile in place. The bikini would have been sending the wrong message. Yum yum, available! So I'd pulled on some cut-off jeans and a Fantasia t-shirt. I pushed open the screen door.
"Alcide," I said, truly glad to see him.
We gave each other a brief hug. He felt awfully warm, since all my recent hugging experiences had been with the less-than-room-temperature Eric. I felt a sort of emotional ripple and realized that though Camo was smiling at me, our embrace hadn't been a welcome sight to her.
"Hamilton," I said. I nodded at him since he wasn't within hugging distance.
"Sookie," Alcide said. "Some new members for you to meet. This is Annabel Bannister."
I'd never met anyone who looked less like an Annabelle than this woman. I shook hands with her, of course, and told her I was pleased to meet her.
"You know Ham, and you've met Janilyn too, I think,"
Alcide said, inclining his head back. I nodded at the two at the foot of the steps.
"And this is Basim Al-Saud, my new second,"
Alcide said. It was pronounced Basim, and Alcide trotted the name out like he introduced Arabic people to me all the time. "Okie dokie."
"Howdy-do, Basim," I said. I held out my hand.
One of the meanings of second, I knew, was the person who scares the shit out of everyone, and Basim seemed well qualified for the job. Somewhat reluctantly, he extended his own hand to mine. I shook it, wondering what I'd get from him. Wares are often very hard to read because of their dual nature. Sure enough, I didn't get specific thoughts, only a confused blur of mistrust and aggression and lust. Funny, that was pretty much what I was getting from the misnamed Annabelle.
"How long have you been in Shreveport?"
I asked politely. I glanced from Annabelle to Basim to include them both in the question.
6 months, Annabelle said. I transferred from the Outkiller pack in South Dakota.
So she was in the Air Force. She'd been stationed in South Dakota and then reassigned to Barksdale Air Force Base in Bossier City, adjacent to Shreveport.
"I've been here 2 months, Basim said. I'm learning to like it."
Though he looked exotic, he had only the faintest trace of an accent, and his English was much more precise than mine. Going strictly by the haircut, he was definitely not in the armed services.
"Basim left his old pack in Houston," Alcide said easily, "and we're glad he's become one of us."
We didn't include Ham Bond. I might not be able to read Ham's mind as clearly as if he were human, but he was no big Basim fan. Neither was Janilyn, who seemed to regard Basim with both lust and resentment. There was lots of lust going around the pack this evening. Looking at Basim and Alcide, that wasn't too hard to understand.
"You have a good time here tonight, Basim, Annabelle," I said, before turning to Alcide. "Alcide, my property extends maybe an acre beyond the stream to the east, about 5 acres south to the dirt track that leads to the oil well, and north around the back of the cemetery."
The pack leader nodded.
"I called Bill last night, and he's okay with us spilling over into his woods. He's not going to be at home until dawn, so we won't be bothering him. What about you, Sookie? Are you going into Shreveport tonight or staying home?"
"I'll be here. If you need me for anything, just come to the door."
I smiled at all of them. Annabelle thought,
"Not effing likely, Blondie."
"But you might need the phone," I said to her, and she jumped. "Or some first aid. After all, Annabelle, you never know what you're going to meet up with."
Though I'd started out smiling, there was no smile on my face by the time I finished.
people should make an effort to be polite.
Thanks again for the use of your land. We'll be heading into the woods,
Alcide said quickly. The dark was falling steadily, and I could see the other wares drifting into the cover of the trees. One of the women threw back her head and yipped. Basim's eyes were rounder and more golden already.
Have a good night, I said, as I stepped back and latched the screen door.
The three wares started down the front steps. Alcide's voice drifted back. He was saying, I told you she was telepathic, to Annabelle, as they went across the driveway into the woods, trailed by Ham. Janilyn suddenly started running for the tree line. She was so anxious to change. But it was Basim who glanced back at me as I pushed the wooden door shut. It was the kind of look you get from the animals in the zoo. And then it was full dark. The wares were a bit of a disappointment. They didn't make as much noise as I thought they would. I stayed in the house, of course, all locked up, and I pulled my curtains closed, which wasn't my normal habit. After all, I lived in the middle of the woods. I watched a little television, and I read some. Somewhat later, while I was brushing my teeth, I heard howling. I thought it came from far off, probably near the eastern edge of my property. Early the next morning, just as dawn was breaking, I woke up because I heard car engines. The wares were taking their departure. I almost turned over to go back to sleep, but I realized I had to get up and pay a little trip to the bathroom. After I took care of that, I was a little more awake. I padded down the hall to the living room and peeked through a gap in the front curtains. Out of the tree line came Ham Bond, a bit worse for wear. He was talking to Alcide. Their trucks were the only remaining vehicles. Annabelle appeared a moment after. As I looked at the early morning light falling across the dewy grass, the three wares walked across the lawn slowly, clothed as they had been the night before, but carrying their shoes. They looked exhausted but happy. Their clothes weren't bloody, but their faces and arms were speckled. They'd had a successful hunt. I had a Bambi twinge, but I suppressed it. This was little different from going up in a blind with a rifle. A few seconds later, Basim emerged from the woods. In the slanted light, he looked like a woodland creature, his wild hair full of bits of leaf and twig. There was something ancient about Basim al-Saud. I had to wonder how he'd become a werewolf in wolfless Arabia. As I watched, Basim turned away from the other three and came to my front porch. He knocked, low and firm. I counted to 10 and opened the door. I tried not to stare at the blood. You could tell he'd washed his face in the stream, but he'd missed his neck.
Miss Stuckos, good morning,
Basim said courteously.
Alcide says I should tell you that other creatures have been passing through your property.
I could feel the pucker between my eyes as I frowned. What kind, Basim?
At least one was a fairy, he said. Possibly more than one fairy, but one for sure.
That was incredible for about 6 reasons. Are these tracks or traces fresh or a few weeks old?
Very fresh, he said, and the scent of vampire is strong too. That's a bad mixture.
That's unpleasant news, but something I needed to know. Thanks for telling me.
And there's a body.
I stared at him, willing my face to stillness. I have a lot of practice at not showing what I'm thinking. Any telepath has to be good at that. How old a body? I asked, when I was sure I had my voice under control.
Around 1.5 years, maybe a little less.
Basim wasn't making a big deal about finding a body. He was strictly letting me know it was there.
It's quite far back, buried very deeply.
I didn't say anything. Jeez Louise, must be Debbie Pelt. Since Eric had recovered his memory of that night, that's one thing I'd never asked him, where he'd buried her body after I'd killed her. Basim's dark eyes examined me with great attention.
Alcide wants you to call if you need help or advice, he said finally.
Tell Alcide I appreciate the offer,
and thanks again for letting me know.
He nodded, and then he was halfway back to the truck, where Annabelle sat with her head resting on Alcide's shoulder. I raised my hand to them as Alcide started the truck, and I shut my door firmly as they left. I had a lot to think about.
Chapter 2. I went back to the kitchen, looking forward to my coffee and a slice of the applesauce bread Hallie Belfleur had dropped off at the bar the day before. She was a nice young woman, and I was real glad she and Andy were expecting a baby. I'd heard that Andy's grandmother, ancient Mrs. Caroline Belfleur, was beside herself with delight, and I didn't doubt it for a moment. I tried to think about good things, like Hallie's baby, Tara's pregnancy, and the last night I'd spent with Eric. But the disturbing news Basim had told me gnawed at me all morning. Of all the ideas I had, calling the Renard Parish's sheriff's office was the one that got almost zero brain time. There was no way I could tell them why I was worried. The wares were out, and there was nothing illegal about letting them hunt on my land. But I couldn't picture myself telling Sheriff Dearborn that a ware had told me fairies had been crossing my property. Here's the thing. As far as I'd known until this moment, all the fairies except my cousin Claude had been barred from the human world. At least all the fairies in America. I'd never wondered about those in other countries, and now I closed my eyes and winced at my own stupidity. My great-grandfather Niall had closed all the portals between the Fey world and ours. At least that's what he told me he was going to do, and I assumed they were all gone, except for Claude, who'd lived among humans as long as I'd known him. So how come there'd been a fairy tromping through my woods? And who could I ask for advice on the situation? I couldn't just sit on my hands and do nothing. My great-grandfather had been looking for the self-loathing, half-human renegade Dermot until the moment he closed the portal. I needed to face the possibility that Dermot, who was simply insane, had been left in the human world. However it had come about, I had to believe that Fey proximity to my house couldn't be a good thing. I needed to talk to someone about this. I might confide in Eric, since he was my lover, or in Sam, because he was my friend, or even in Bill, because his land shared a boundary with mine, and he would also be concerned. Or I could talk to Claude, see if he'd give me any insight into the situation. I sat at the table with my coffee and my hunk of applesauce bread, too distracted to read or turn on the radio to catch the news. I finished one cup of coffee and started another. I showered in an automatic sort of way and made my bed and did all my usual morning tasks. Finally, I sat down at the computer I'd brought home from my cousin Hadley's New Orleans apartment and I checked my email. I'm not methodical about doing this. I know very few people who might send me email, and I simply haven't gotten into the habit of looking at my computer every day. I had several messages. I didn't recognize the return address on the first one. I moved the mouse to click on it. A knock at the back door made me jump like a frog. I pushed back my chair. After a second's hesitation, I got the shotgun from the closet in the front room. Then I went to the back door and peeked through the new peephole. Speak of the devil, I muttered. This day was just full of surprises, and it wasn't even 10 o'clock. I put down the shotgun and opened the door. Claude, I said, come in. You want a drink? I've got Coke and coffee and orange juice. I noticed that Claude had the strap of a big tote bag slung over his shoulder. From its solid appearance, the bag was jammed with clothes. I didn't remember inviting him to a slumber party. He came in, looking serious and somehow unhappy. Claude had been in the house before, but not often, and he looked around at my kitchen. The kitchen happened to be new because the old kitchen had burned down, so I had shiny appliances and everything still looked squared away and level.
Sookie, I can't stay in our house by myself any longer. Can I bunk with you for a while, cousin?
I tried to pick my jaw up off the floor before he noticed how shocked I was. First, that Claude had confessed he needed help. Second, that he confessed it to me,
And third, that Claude would stay in the same house with me when he normally thought of me as about on the same level as a beetle. I'm a human, and I'm a woman, so I've got two strikes against me as far as Claude's concerned. Plus, of course, there was the whole issue of Claudine dying in my defense.
Claude, I said, trying to sound only sympathetic. Have a seat. What's wrong?
I glanced at the shotgun, unaccountably glad it was within reach. Claude gave it only a casual glance. After a moment, he put down his bag and simply stood there, as if he couldn't figure out what to do next. It seemed surreal to be in my kitchen alone with my fairy cousin. Though he had apparently made the choice to continue living among humans, he was far from warm and fuzzy about them. Claude, albeit physically beautiful, was an indiscriminate jerk, as far as I'd observed. But he'd gotten his ears surgically altered to look human, so he wouldn't have to expend his energy perpetuating a human appearance. And as far as I knew, Claude's sexual connections had always been with human males.
You're still living in the house you shared with your sisters?
It was a prosaic three-bedroom ranch in Monroe.
Yes.
Okay, I was looking for a little expansion on the theme here.
The bars aren't keeping you occupied?
Between owning and operating two strip clubs, hooligans, and a new place he'd just taken over, and performing at hooligans at least once a week, I'd imagine Claude to be both busy and well-to-do. Since he was handsome to the nth degree, he made a lot of money in tips, and the occasional modeling job boosted his income. Claude could make even the most staid grandmother drool. Being in the same room with someone so gorgeous gave women a contact high. Until he opened his mouth. Plus, he no longer had to share the club income with his sister.
I'm busy, and I don't lack for money, but without the company of my own kind, I feel I'm starving.
Are you serious? I said without thinking, and then I could have kicked myself. But Claude needing me, or anyone for that matter, seemed so unlikely. His request to stay with me was wholly unexpected and unwelcome. But my gran chided me mentally. I was looking at a member of my family, one of the few still living and or accessible to me. My relationship with my great-grandfather Niall had ended when he'd retreated into Faerie and pulled the door shut behind him. Though Jason and I had mended our fences, my brother very much led his own life. My mom, my dad, and my grandmother were dead. My Aunt Linda and my cousin Hadley were dead, and I rarely saw Hadley's little son. I had depressed the hell out of myself in the space of a minute.
Do I have enough fairy in me to be any help to you?
That was all I could think of to say.
Yes,
he said very simply.
I already feel better.
This seemed a weird echo of my conversation with Bill. Claude halfway smiled. If Claude looked incredible when he was unhappy, he looked divine when he smiled.
Since you've been in the company of fairies, it's accentuated your streak of fairy essence. By the way, I have a letter for you.
Who from?
Niall.
How's that possible? I understood the fae world was shut off now.
He has his ways,
Claude said evasively.
He's the only prince now. And very powerful.
He has his ways.
I said. Okay, let's see it. Claude pulled an envelope out of his overnight bag. It was buff-colored and sealed with a blue blob of wax. In the wax was imprinted a bird, its wings spread in flight.
So there's a fairy mailbox? I said. And you can send and receive letters?
This letter, anyway.
Fae were very good at evasion. I huffed out a breath of exasperation. I got a knife and slid it under the seal. The paper I extracted from the envelope had a very curious texture.
Dearest great-granddaughter,
it began,
there are things I didn't get to say to you, and many things I didn't get to do for you before my plans collapsed in the war.
Okay.
This letter is written on the skin of one of the water sprites who drowned your parents.
Ick!
I cried, and dropped the letter on the kitchen table. Claude was by my side in a flash.
What's wrong?
He asked, looking around the kitchen as if he expected to see a troll pop up.
This is skin! Skin!
What else would Nye all write on?
He looked genuinely taken aback.
Ew!
Even to myself, I sounded a little too girly-girly. But honestly, skin?
It's clean,
Claude said, clearly hoping that would solve my problem.
It's been processed.
I gritted my teeth and reached down for my great-grandfather's letter. I took a deep, steadying breath. Actually, the material hardly smelled at all. Smothering a desire to put on oven mitts, I made myself focus on reading.
Before I left your world, I made sure one of my human agents talked to several people who can help you evade the scrutiny of the human government. When I sold the pharmaceutical company we owned, I used much of my profit to ensure your freedom.
I blinked because my eyes were tearing up a little. He might not be a typical great-grandfather, but by golly, he'd done something wonderful for me. He's bribed some government officials to call off the FBI? Is that what he's done?
I have no idea,
Claude said, shrugging. He wrote me, too, to let me know that I had an extra $300,000 in my bank account. Also, Claudine hadn't made a will since she didn't expect to die. She had expected to raise a child with a fairy lover I'd never met. Claude shook himself and said in a cracked voice,
Niall produced a human body and a will, so I don't have to wait years to prove her death. She left me almost everything. She said this to our father, Dylan, when she appeared to him as part of her death ritual.
Fairies told their relatives they had passed after they'd translated to spirit form. I wondered why Claudine had appeared to Dylan instead of to her brother, and I asked Claude, phrasing it as tactfully as I could.
The next oldest receives the vision, Claude said stiffly. Our sister Claudette appeared to me, since I was older than her by a minute. Claudine made her death ritual to our father, since she was older than I.
So she told your dad she wanted you to have her share of the clubs? It was pretty lucky for Claude that Claudine had let someone else know about her wishes. I wondered what happened if the oldest fae in the line was the one who was doing the dying. I'd save that question for later.
Yes, her share of the house, her car, though I already had one.
For some reason, Claude was looking self-conscious and guilty. Why on earth would he look guilty? How do you ride in it? I asked, sidetracked, since fairies have such issues with iron.
I wear the invisible gloves over exposed skin, he said. I put them on after every shower, and I've built up a little more tolerance with every decade of living in the human world.
I returned to the letter.
There may be more I can do for you. I will let you know. Claudine left you a gift.
Oh, Claudine left me something too? What? I looked up at Claude, who didn't look exactly pleased. I think he hadn't known the contents of the letter for certain. If Niall hadn't revealed Claudine's legacy, Claude might not have. Fairies don't lie, but they don't always tell all the truth, either.
She left you the money in her bank account, he said, resigned. It contains her wages from the department store and her share of the income from the clubs.
Aw, that was so nice of her. I blinked a couple of times. I tried not to touch my savings account, and my checking account wasn't too healthy because I'd missed a lot of work recently. Plus, my tips had suffered because I'd been so down. Smiling waitresses make more than sad waitresses. I could sure use a few $100s. Maybe I could buy some new clothes, and I really needed a new toilet in the hall bathroom. How do you do a transfer like that?
You'll get a check from Mr. Cataliades. He is handling the estate.
Mr. Cataliades, if he had a first name, I'd never heard it, was a lawyer. And he was also, mostly, a demon. He handled the human legal affairs of many supernaturals in Louisiana. I felt subtly better when Claude said his name because I knew Mr. Catalides had no bone to pick with me. Well, I had to make up my mind about Claude's housemate proposal.
Let me make a phone call, I said, and pointed to the coffee pot. If you need some more, I can make some. Are you hungry?
Claude shook his head.
Then after I call Amelia, you and I need to have a little chit-chat.
I went to the phone in my bedroom. Amelia was an earlier riser than me because my job kept me up late. She answered her cell phone on the second ring.
Suki,
she said, and she didn't sound as gloomy as I'd anticipated.
What's up?
I couldn't think of any casual way to lead into my question.
My cousin would like to stay here for a while, I said. He could use the bedroom across from mine, but if he stays upstairs, we'd each have a little more privacy. If you're coming back anytime soon, of course he'll go on and put his stuff in the downstairs bedroom. I just didn't want you to come back to find someone sleeping in your bed.
There was a long silence. I braced myself.
Suki, she said, I love you. You know that. And I loved living with you. It was a godsend to have somewhere to go after that thing with Bob. But right now, I'm stuck in New Orleans for a while. I'm just in the middle of a lot of stuff.
I had expected this, but it was still a tough moment. I hadn't really expected her to come back. I'd hoped she'd heal faster in New Orleans, and it was true she hadn't mentioned Trey. It sounded like more than grieving was going on.
You're okay?
I am, she said. And I've been training with Octavia some more. Octavia, her mentor in witchcraft, had returned to New Orleans with her long-lost love. Also, I finally got judged. I've got to pay a penalty for, you know, the thing with Bob. The thing with Bob was Amelia's way of referring to accidentally turning her lover into a cat. Octavia had returned Bob to his human form, but naturally Bob hadn't been happy with Amelia, and neither had Octavia. Though Amelia had been training in her craft, clearly transformational magic had been beyond her skills.
So they're not going to whip you or anything, right?
I asked, trying to sound as if I were joking. After all, it's not like he died. Just lost a big chunk of his life and missed Katrina entirely, including being able to inform his family that he'd survived.
Some of them would whip me if they could, but that's not how we witches roll.
Amelia tried to laugh, but it wasn't convincing. As a penalty, I've got to do, like, community service.
Like picking up litter or tutoring kids?
Well, mixing potions and making up bags of common ingredients so they're ready to hand, working extra hours in the magic store, and killing chickens for rituals every now and then, doing a lot of legwork without pay.
That sucks,
I said, because money is almost always a touchy subject with me. Amelia had grown up rich, but I had not. If someone deprives me of income, I get pissed off. I had a fleeting moment of wondering how much Claudine's bank account might have had in it, and I blessed her for thinking of me.
Yeah, well, Katrina wiped the New Orleans Covens out. We lost some members who'll never come back, so we don't get their contributions anymore, and I never use my dad's money for the coven.
So, the bottom line,
I said, I've got to stay down here. I don't know if I'll ever make it back to Bon Ton. And I'm really sorry about that, because I really liked living with you.
Same here. I took a deep breath, determined not to sound forlorn.
What about your stuff?
Not that there's that much here, but still. I'll leave it there for now. I've got everything here I need, and the rest is yours to use as you see fit till I can make arrangements to get it.
We talked a bit more, but we'd said everything important.
I forgot to ask her if Octavia had found a way to dissolve Eric's blood bond with me. Possibly I wasn't very interested in an answer. I hung up, feeling both sad and glad. Glad that Amelia was working off her debt to her coven and that she was happier than she'd been in Bon Ton after Trey's death, and sad because I understood she didn't expect to return. After a moment of silent farewell to her, I went to the kitchen to tell Claude that the upstairs was all his. After I'd absorbed his gratified smile, I moved on to another issue. I didn't know how to approach my question, so finally I simply asked him. "Have you been out in my woods back of the house?" His face went absolutely blank.
"Why would I do that?"
he said. "I didn't ask for your motivation. I asked if you'd been there." I know evasion when I hear it.
"No,"
he said. "That's bad news."
"Why?"
"Because the Wares tell me a fairy's been back there very recently." I kept my eyes fixed on his. "And if it's not you, who could it be?"
"There aren't many fairies left,"
Claude said. Again, evasion. "If there are other fairies that didn't make it in before the portal was shut, you could hang around with them," I said. "You wouldn't need to stay with me, with my little dash of fairy blood. Yet here you are. And somewhere in my woods is yet another fairy." I eyed his expression. "I don't see you excited about tracking down whoever it is. What's the deal? Why don't you dash out there, find the fairy, do some bonding, and be happy?" Claude looked down.
"The last portal to close was in your woods," he said. "Possibly it's not completely shut. And I know Dermot, your great uncle, was on the outside. If Dermot is the fairy the Wares sensed, he wouldn't be glad to see me."
I thought he would have more to say, but he stopped right there. That was plenty of bad news, and another whopping dollop of dodging the issue. I was still dubious about his goals, but Claude was family, and I had precious little family left. "All right," I said, opening a kitchen drawer where I stowed odds and ends. "Here's a key. We'll see how this pans out. I have to go to work this afternoon, by the way, and we have to have a talk. You know that I've got a boyfriend, right?" I was already feeling kind of embarrassed.
"Who are you seeing?"
Claude asked, with a sort of professional interest. Eric Northman?" Claude whistled. He looked both admiring and cautious.
"Does Eric spend the night? I need to know if he's gonna jump me."
Claude looked as though that wouldn't be totally unwelcome, but the pertinent issue was that fairies are really intoxicating to vampires, like catnip to cats. Eric would have a hard time restraining himself from biting if Claude was close to him. "That would probably end badly for you," I said, "but I think with a little care, we can get around it." Eric seldom spent the night at my house because he liked to be back in Shreveport before dawn. He had so much work to get through every night that he'd found it was better for him to wake up in Shreveport. I do have a hidden place where a vampire can stay in relative safety, but it's not exactly deluxe, not like Eric's house. I was a little more concerned about the possibility of Claude bringing strange men back to my house. I didn't want to encounter someone I didn't know when I was on my way to the kitchen in my nightie. Amelia had had a couple of overnight guests, but they'd been people I knew. I took a deep breath, hoping what I was about to say wouldn't come out homophobic. "Claude, it's not that I don't want you to have a good time," I said, wishing this conversation were over and done with. I admired Claude's unblushing acceptance of the fact that I had a sex life, and I only wished I could match that nonchalance.
"If I want to have sex with someone you don't know, I'll take him to my house in Monroe," Claude said with a wicked little smile. He could be perceptive when he chose, I noted. "Or I'll let you know ahead of time. That okay?"
"Sure," I said, surprised at Claude's easy compliance. But he'd said all the right words. I relaxed some as I showed Claude where strategic kitchen stuff was, gave him some tips on the washer and the dryer, and told him the hall bathroom was all his. Then I led him upstairs. Amelia had worked hard on making one of the little bedrooms pretty, and she decorated the other one as a sitting room. She'd taken her laptop with her, but the TV was still there. I checked to make sure that the bed was made up with clean linens and the closet was mostly clear of Amelia's clothing. I pointed out the door to the walk-in attic in case he needed to store anything. Claude pulled it open and took a step inside. He looked around at the shadowy, crowded space.
Generations of Stackhouses had stored things they thought they might need someday, and I admit it was a little on the cluttered and chaotic side.
You need to go through this, he said. Do you even know what's up here?
Family debris, I said, looking in with some dismay. I just never worked up the heart to tackle it since Gran died.
I'll help you, Claude declared. That will be my payment to you for my room.
I opened my mouth to point out that Amelia had given me cash, but then I reflected again that he was family.
That would be great, I said, though I don't know if I'm up to it yet.
My wrists had been aching this morning, though they were definitely better than they'd been. And there are some other jobs around the house that are beyond me, if you wouldn't mind giving a hand. He bowed.
I would be delighted, he said.
This was a different side of Claude from the one I'd come to know and disparage. Grief and loneliness seemed to have woken something in the beautiful fairy. He appeared to have come to the realization that he had to show a little kindness to other people if he wanted to receive kindness in return. Claude seemed to understand that he needed others, especially now that his sisters were gone. I was a little more at ease with our arrangement by the time I left for work. I listened to Claude moving around upstairs for a while, and then he'd come down with an armful of hair care products to arrange in the bathroom. I'd already put out clean towels for him. He seemed satisfied with the bathroom, which was very old-fashioned. But then Claude had been alive in a time before indoor plumbing, so maybe he saw it from a different perspective. Truthfully, hearing someone else in the house had relaxed something deep inside me, a tension I hadn't even known I felt.
Hey, Sam, I said.
He was behind the bar when I came out of the back room, where I'd left my purse and put on an apron. Merlot's wasn't very busy. Holly, as always, was talking to her Hoyt, who was dawdling over his supper. With her Merlot's t-shirt, Holly was wearing pink and green plaid shorts instead of the regulation black.
Looking good, Holly,
I called, and she gave me a radiant smile. While Hoyt beamed, Holly held out her hand to show off a brand new ring. I let out a shriek and hugged her.
Oh, this is so great, I said. Holly, it's so pretty. So, have you picked a date yet?
It'll be in the fall, probably, Holly said. Hoyt has to work long hours through the spring and summer. That's his busy time, so we figured maybe October or November.
Suki,
Hoyt said, his voice dropping and his face growing solemn.
Now that Jason and I have mended our fences, I'm going to ask him to be my best man.
I glanced very quickly over to Holly, who'd never been a big Jason fan. She was still smiling, and if I could detect the reservations she had, Hoyt couldn't. I said,
"He'll be thrilled."
I had to hustle off to make the rounds of my tables, but I smiled while I worked. I wondered if they'd have the ceremony after dark. Then Eric could go with me. That would be great. That would transform me from poor Suki who hasn't even ever been engaged to Suki who brought the gorgeous guy to the wedding. Then I thought of a contingency plan. If the wedding was a daytime wedding, I could get Claude to go with me. He looked exactly like a romance cover model. He'd been a romance cover model. Ever read The Lady and the Stable Boy or Lord Darlington's Naughty Marriage? Woo-hoo! I was unhappily aware that I was thinking about the wedding strictly in terms of my own feelings. But there's nothing more forlorn than being an old maid at a wedding. I realize that it's silly to feel like you're on the shelf at 27, but I'd missed some prime time, and I was increasingly conscious of that fact. So many of my high school friends had gotten married, some more than once, and some of them were pregnant, like Tara, who was coming through the door in an oversized t-shirt. I gave a wave to let her know I'd come talk to her when I could, and I got an iced tea for Dr. Linda Tonneson and a Michelob for Jesse Wayne Cummins.
"What's up, Tara?"
I bent over to give her a neck hug. She had plunked herself down at a table.
"I need some caffeine-free Diet Coke," she said, "and I need a cheeseburger with lots of French fried pickles."
She looked ferocious.
"Sure," I said. "I'll get the Coke and put in your order right now."
When I returned, she drank the whole glass.
"I'll be sorry in 5 minutes because I'll have to go to the bathroom," she said. "All I do is pee and eat."
Tara had big rings under her eyes, and her complexion was not at its best. Where was the glow of pregnancy that I'd heard so much about?
How much longer do you have to go?
3 months, a week, and 3 days.
Dr. Dinwiddie gave you a due date.
JB just can't believe how big I'm getting, Tara said with an eye roll.
He said that? In those words?
Yep. Yes, he did.
Jeez Louise, that boy needs a lesson or two in rephrasing.
I'd settle for him keeping his mouth shut entirely. Tara had married JB, knowing brains weren't his strong suit, and she was reaping the result. But I so wanted them to be happy. I couldn't be all, you made your bed, now you gotta lie in it.
He loves you, I said, trying to sound soothing. He's just...
JB, she said. She shrugged and summoned up a smile. Then Antoine called that my order was up, and the avid expression on Tara's face told me that she was more focused on the food than on her husband's tactlessness. She returned to Tara's talks a happier and fuller woman. As soon as it was dark, I called Eric on my cell while I was in the ladies' room. I hated to sneak off on Sam's time to call my boyfriend, but I needed the support. Now that I had his cell number, I didn't have to call Fantasia, which was both bad and good. I'd never known who was going to answer the phone, and I'm not a universal favorite among Eric's vampires. On the other hand, I miss talking to Pam, Eric's second-in-command. Pam and I are actually almost friends.
I am here, my lover, Eric said.
It was hard not to shiver when I heard his voice, but the atmosphere of the ladies' room in Merlot's was not at all conducive to lust.
Well, I'm here too, obviously.
Listen, I really need to talk to you, I said. Some things have come up.
You're worried?
Yes, with good reason.
I have a meeting in 30 minutes with Victor, Eric said. You know how tense that's likely to be.
I do know, and I'm sorry to pester you with my problems, but you're my boyfriend, and part of being a good boyfriend is listening.
Your boyfriend, he said. That sounds... strange. I am so not a boy.
Poof, Eric! I was exasperated. I don't want to stand here in the bathroom trying to talk terminology. What's the bottom line? Are you going to have free time later or not?
He laughed. Yes, for you. Can you drive over here? Wait, I'll send Pam for you. She'll be at your house at 1 o'clock, all right?
I might have to hurry to get home by then, but it was doable. Okay, and warn Pam that... well... tell her not to get carried away by anything, hear?
Oh, certainly. I'll be glad to pass that very specific message along,
Eric said. He hung up, not big on saying goodbye, like most vampires. This was going to be a very long day. Chapter 3 Luckily for me, all the customers cleared out early, and I was able to get my closing work done in record time. I called, "Good night," over my shoulder and haired out the back door to my car. When I parked behind the house, I noticed Claude's car wasn't there, so he was probably still in Monroe, which simplified matters. I hurried to change clothes and freshen my makeup, and just as I put on some lipstick, Pam knocked at the back door. Pam was looking especially Pamish tonight. Her blonde hair was absolutely straight and shining, her pale blue suit looked like a vintage gem, and she was wearing hose with seams up the back, which she turned around to show me. Wow, I said, which was the only possible response. You're looking great. She put my red skirt and red and white blouse to shame.
Yes, she said with considerable satisfaction. I am. Ah, she became utterly still. Do I smell fairy?
You do, but there's not one here now, so just rein it in. My cousin Claude was here today. He's going to be bunking with me for a while.
Claude, the mouth-wateringly beautiful asshole?
Claude's fame preceded him. Yes, that Claude.
Why? Why is he staying with you?
He's lonely, I said.
Do you really believe that?
Pam's pale brows were arched incredulously. Well... yes, I do.
Why else would Claude want to stay at my house, which was not convenient to his job?
He certainly didn't want to get in my pants, and he hadn't asked to borrow money.
This is some fairy intrigue, Pam said. You were a fool to be taken in.
Nobody likes being called a fool. Pam had stepped over the line, but then tact was not her middle name. Pam, that's enough, I said. I must have sounded serious, because she stared at me for all of 15 seconds.
I've offended you, she said, though not as if the idea gave her pain.
Yeah, you have. Claude's missing his sisters. There aren't any fairies left for him to intrigue with since Niall closed the portal, or doors, or whatever the heck he closed. I'm the closest Claude's got to his kind, which is pretty pitiful since I just have a dab of fairy in me.
Let's go, Pam said. Eric will be waiting.
Changing the subject when she had nothing left to say was another of Pam's characteristics. I had to smile and shake my head.
How'd the meeting with Victor go? I asked.
It would be a good thing if Victor met with an unfortunate accident.
You really mean that?
No, I really wish someone would kill him.
Me too.
Our eyes met, and she gave me a brisk nod. We were in sync on the Victor issue.
I suspect his every statement, she said. I question his every decision. I think he's out to take Eric's position. He doesn't want to be the king's emissary any longer. He wants to carve out his own territory.
I pictured a fur-clad Victor paddling a canoe down the Red River with an Indian maiden sitting stoically behind him. I laughed. As we got into Pam's car, she looked at me darkly.
I don't understand you, she said. I really don't.
We went out to Hummingbird Road and turned north.
Why would being a sheriff in Louisiana be a step above being the emissary of Felipe, who has a rich kingdom?
I asked very seriously, to make up my lost ground.
Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven, Pam said.
I knew she was quoting someone, but I didn't have a clue who it was. Louisiana is hell? Las Vegas is heaven? I could almost believe some cosmopolitan vampire would consider Louisiana as less than desirable as a permanent residence, but Las Vegas, divine? I didn't think so.
I'm just saying, Pam shrugged. It's time for Victor to get out from under Felipe's thumb. They've been together a long time. Victor is ambitious.
That's true. What do you think Victor's strategy is? How do you think he plans to dislodge Eric?
He'll try to discredit him, Pam said, without pausing a beat.
She'd really been thinking about this.
If Victor can't do that, he'll try to kill Eric, but he won't do it directly in combat.
He's scared of fighting Eric?
Yes, Pam said, smiling. I do believe he is.
We'd reached the interstate and were on our way west to Shreveport.
If he challenged Eric, it would be Eric's right to send me in first. I would so love to fight Victor.
Her fangs gleamed briefly in the dashboard light.
Does Victor have a second? Wouldn't he send that second in?
Pam cocked her head to one side. She seemed to be thinking about it as she passed a semi.
His second is Bruno Brazel. He was with Victor the night Eric surrendered to Nevada, she said. Short beard, an earring. If Eric allowed me to fight for him, Victor might send in Bruno. He's impressive, I grant you, but I would kill him in 5 minutes or less. You can put money on that.
Pam, who had been a Victorian middle-class young lady with a secret wild streak, had been liberated by becoming a vampire. I had never asked Eric why he'd chosen Pam.